I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Lisa Herzog, Dean and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. We're discussing her recent book, Citizen Knowledge, Market, Experts, and the Infrastructure of Democracy from Oxford University Press. Herzog's research is on the philosophical dimensions of markets, liberalism and social justice, and ethics and organizations. She is the author of several books and many articles. Well, first of all, Lisa Herzog, welcome back to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lisa, I love this book. It's an excellent book about knowledge and democracy and what the challenges are to having a responsible democratic approach to knowledge generation and transmission. I applaud you for the book. Can you get us started by just talking a little bit about what motivated you to write this book and this particular topic?
Yes, thank you. So it was 2016 that I started thinking about this. And there were two ways of thinking about what got me into this, really. The first is that there were all these political events. There was the Trump election, there was the Brexit vote in the UK. There were also other questions about, for example, scandals around agricultural products being safe or not, and who had funded what studies. So it seemed that there is something that's not working smoothly about the relation between knowledge, citizens' knowledge, but also expert knowledge and the democratic processes. For me personally, I had worked before on ethics and organizations, and I had done interviews with practitioners about their experience of these ethical challenges. And one of the most fascinating topics in what became then this book on ethics and organizations that I really hadn't had on the radar, but that people told me about, was the way in which knowledge in organizations gets used as a tool and is used strategically in order to push one's own interests and so on. And so another way of getting at these questions around the political use of knowledge for me was, well, do we only see these phenomena within organizations, say within a company or within a university, that people use knowledge strategically? Or isn't that also a bigger phenomenon that we also see at the political level? And so from these two angles, real life politics and also my own research interests, I got into this field that is now called political epistemology.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think of this tension as a very old tension, and certainly in the history of political thought, between knowledge and democracy. I mean, you think of Plato's Republic; it goes way back there, and the way in which Plato described the kinds of tensions between, you know, an appeal to knowledge, an appeal to truth, which has a kind of authoritative command, and then democracy, which is, you know, it's at its heart a kind of anti-authoritarian. You know,
exactly.
And it's certainly in its populist variants, as we see today, skepticism about experts. You add in a component which is very useful in the modern age about the ways in which liberal democracy and capitalism particularly can have some corrupting influence on knowledge through the pursuit of the profit motive, for example. So maybe you could just maybe start by talking about, you know, sort of generally that kind of tension between democracy and knowledge, and the kinds of examples maybe that come to mind for you, and the ways in which this is the kind of problem that stands behind your project.
Yes. So in a nutshell, the tension is between unequal authority when it comes to knowledge. So different people know a different amount of things about different areas of life. Someone is an expert on, say, medicine because they studied it for 10 years and they practice it and they are part of a community of other experts in this field. And then me as a philosopher, if I want to know something about a certain disease, I simply cannot acquire that level of expertise. I can maybe Google around a bit or ask a few people, but it wouldn't get me to the depth of understanding that a real expert on that field would have. And I mean, if they have questions about philosophy, they would come to one of us. So that's the division of labor and the division of knowledge that is simply a fact. And I mean, some theorists have tried to minimize what authority knowledge really can have, and saying lay people also know things, and maybe experts aren't so great as experts. And you know, there is some truth in that, but I still think it's a basic fact of modern societies that we do have this division of labor. And then you get this tension between unequal authority with regard to expertise and the basic egalitarian ideas about democracy, equal votes, everyone should have the same amount of voice. We all think of each other as moral equals in democratic societies. And that was, for me, a fundamental tension that I wanted to think about. And then you already mentioned there is also the fact that we live in societies in which markets and capital and all these things play quite a role. And when you look at the relation between market behavior and knowledge, you get this dimension of self-interest coming in, because markets suggest that you need to be, you know, behave in your own interest. You need to pursue profits, or at least that's what the capitalist logic suggests. And so from a profit perspective, knowledge is something that you can either make money with, then you want to keep it to yourself, not let others access it. If knowledge comes with certain responsibilities, it might suggest, for example, that you have certain environmental responsibilities, then you don't want to see it. You don't want to be associated with it, let's say. And you try to push it into the public realm and you say, oh, that's not something we are responsible for. And in very concrete terms, that's the kind of behavior that you also see when you look at how, for example, the tobacco industry has dealt with the knowledge about the medical consequences, the harmful medical consequences of smoking and also passive smoking. So they had their own research, and there was other research coming out about smoking being harmful. But because it was a threat to their profit-making possibilities, they tried to suppress this for decades, really, by confusing the public about what the state of the art really was, by using the fact that science always grows on and profits from people having different hypotheses about certain causes of diseases. They threw money at researchers that had other ideas about lung cancer, for example, not about the connection between smoking and lung cancer, but maybe genetic causes and so on. And they managed to postpone the regulation of smoking really for a very long time. And I mean, people have tried to calculate the number of deaths that this has caused, and it's in the thousands, of course, hundreds of thousands. So we cannot just look at the relation between experts and citizens in this dualistic relation. We need to think about the fact that there are interested parties, and that we live in highly unequal societies in which certain parties can pay for things and others can't. And then it becomes a kind of complicated triangle, which becomes even more complicated if you also take into account that there is this powerful narrative that economists from the Austrian tradition, also to some extent from the Chicago tradition, have pushed about markets being these fantastic instruments for aggregating knowledge, to argue against state regulation of any kind. And so I try to bring these different strands together and develop a framework for thinking about what democracies should do in these situations.
And I also think, particularly in the, you know, in the United States, there's a kind of epistemic crisis, you could say, that's related to the culture wars or polarization in American politics, in the sense that it's, you know, at some points, I think different political tribes, you could call them, are living in different epistemic worlds entirely, right? Yeah. So there's, you know, sort of layered over the problem of the division of labor in complicated societies in which it's very difficult for any sort of way to access and evaluate truth. There's always this, there's also a sense there's just sort of, you know, a chasm that emerges through the kind of you know, emergence of these differences and over value and ends of political life. I don't know if you know how to line that up with the market and with the expert community.
That is an interesting question. It's not at the center of my book. I tried to discuss it a little bit at the end, basically saying that these two-party systems are dangerous for that very reason. But of course, the European societies that have multi-party systems still have certain epistemic chasms between different groups, and you get these self-reinforcing effects where people who feel that they somehow have a shared identity then also tend to assume similar issues. And I mean, in the US, one example would be that, you know, if you were a naive outside observer, you wouldn't think that people who have certain views about abortion necessarily also have certain views about gun control. Those could go completely, you know, cross purposes, but as a matter of fact, they align because they are part of certain party identities. And it's maybe no accident that certain topics are particularly prone to polarization, but there are also some things where it really becomes, it looks like, okay, people just hold certain views because it belongs to their camp. And they trust certain experts over others. And what you then lose, and what I think is very dangerous, is the ability of saying, look, there are certain facts that we simply need to agree on, and we can do so because experts really have good methods for arriving at these facts. And there are ideally also different methods that confirm the same empirical picture. And we will still have political divides about values and about interests. But let's agree on certain facts. And this is an ideal, and I'm fully aware that it's hard to realize in practice. I don't want to be naive about the difficulties of how facts and norms and methods are all entangled with each other. But still, I think it's something very important that there can be ways of agreeing on at least minimal facts, because otherwise the very idea of having democratic politics as being about the things that we do together in a kind of shared reality, that breaks apart. And then the question is, well, what remains other than antagonism? Because I want my worldview to be the one that everyone accepts. And that, I think, is a very dangerous stance for Democrats to have.
Right. Yeah. So this is the problem, I think, in a nutshell, right? That the sort of the disintegrating character of the modern age is, you know, has just been sort of accelerated in the ways that you suggest, either through sort of the division of labor, modern capitalism, or, you know, these ways in which the sort of party polarization has really pushed people apart. And so the kind of question is how to integrate the integrative moment to bring a sort of epistemic communities back together, you know. And so just, you know, the way I interpret what you're doing here, and so I'll just like throw your thesis, general thesis at you, and then you tell me where up what I missed. But
go ahead, please.
I mean, I take it in a nutshell what you're after is there are effectively three different kinds of knowledge mechanisms in society. That is, mechanisms that sort of generate and transmit knowledge from one generation to another. And those are the market, experts, generally understood, and then sort of democratic deliberative bodies. And I mean, one of the interesting things about your book is, you know, this sort of, you've already touched on it there, this sort of you're not an ideal theorist. You don't want to push that any one of these organizations is what we should double down on. You know, we shouldn't, like libertarians or neoliberals, think that the market is the solution to all our knowledge problems. We shouldn't, like the deliberative Democrats, think that, you know, democratic deliberation is the solution to all our problems, and we should just find unity there. And we shouldn't, finally, think that experts are the solution to all our problems, and we should just, you know, like what we did in COVID, you know, what we were supposed to do in COVID, just trust the experts, right? Like, that's not a solution. But is it too simple to say that you're a pluralist about these sorts of things, that there's these three different mechanisms, and we should be kind of pluralists about how to approach truth in the modern age?
I guess for the here and now, totally. But we should also think about what's the right place and what's the right role for each of these. And if you ask me about the sort of longer term utopian vision, then I would probably say I'm most closely related to the deliberative Democrats, in the sense that I do think that a further democratization of many spheres of life, and not only in the sense of representative democracy, but also in a participatory approach of people really doing things together, deciding things together in the workplace, on school boards, whatever. That would be my long-term vision. But that doesn't mean that such a society couldn't also decide together, okay, for certain types of knowledge aggregation, we set up a very clearly delineated, very well-regulated market because it can fulfill certain epistemic functions. The mistake would be to think that markets have these epistemic or these epistemically beneficial features just on their own. You really need to design them very well to make sure that the arguments actually work and that it makes sense to say, oh, the market can here aggregate certain kinds of information. It has been wildly generalized in a way that's just not plausible. So I think that maybe the thrust of the book is very much against this market narrative of knowledge. And then when it comes to experts, I think they'll not really get rid of them, even in a ideally democratic future. We need to think about how to integrate the realms in which expert discourse takes place and they really generate new knowledge with the broader deliberative discussions that take place in society. And we need to manage the interfaces between the expert communities and society at large.
Yeah, I think it leads me to my question about democratic institutionalism, because I think your gloss on your thesis was helpful there, because in the sort of distinction between short term and long term, maybe you could say a little bit about democratic institutionalism, because as I understood what you're doing, basically, you know, these three domains of knowledge need to be assessed, in other words, against a sort of background of like a democratic regime type, not necessarily like any particular democratic institution, but against like the norms and aspirations of democratic life. So maybe say a little bit about democratic institutionalism and how that fits in your argument.
Yeah, so what I mean by democratic institutionalism is to not only look at the principles of democracy, what they are and how exactly you frame them and so on, but to really also think through the institutional settings in which democratic values can be realized and the conditions of the possibility, to use this Kantian formula, of democracy really functioning well and being stable in the long run. And then the focus gets shifted from principles to institutions. And I take it that for many democratic principles, there's not only one way in which we can implement principles. And there may be better or worse ways for different spheres of life. So, for example, often you have questions about the relation between, say, elections and autocratic methods for choosing representatives of the people, because in many situations we cannot have everyone who's affected by a decision participate in the discussion. So we need to somehow find a representative sample of people. And then in some contexts, elections make a lot of sense. In other contexts, drawing people randomly through lotteries out of the general population can also make sense. And I take it that context matters a lot. And so for thinking about what are the best democratic institutions, we need to think about context. And then this fact of the differentiation of knowledge is one of these contextual factors. And we need to design our democratic institutions such that what I call the epistemic infrastructure of democracy functions well, because citizens want democracy to also not always make bad decisions, to put it very bluntly. And if a democratic system fails to incorporate what experts can tell us about certain areas of life, or if the experts don't convince citizens about what's going on, or so you get the other direction of more technocratic tendencies, or if the way markets function cannot really be justified, then citizens will also blame democracy for that. Even though you might say, well, it's an accident that democracy has these unfortunate outcomes, we should just dig in our heels and say, well, the democratic principles matter more. Who cares about outcomes? All these empirical things there. But I think that's just a very risky strategy, because people care about outcomes as well. And so we should. So my strategy is to say, normatively speaking, I'm committed to the democratic principles, but I want to think critically about the institutional implementation and how we can do better given these challenges about knowledge, and there are lots of other challenges, of course, as well, to see how the principles can really be realized and we can have a stable, well-functioning system.
You and I have both done work before on Hegel. I was wondering if I smell the scent of Hegel in your work.
Yes.
I've also on this podcast had the tendency of explaining concepts with reference to difficult thinkers like Hegel. So this is yet again the tendency. But in any case, I mean, Hegel has this view against folks like Kant, where you have a sort of, you know, you reject a kind of ideal theory approach to politics and instead turn to, you know, where, you know, rational and normativity emerges, which is through the concrete institutions of ethical life. And Hegel thinks that modern ethical life has complicated in terms of having different kinds of structures that are in tension with one another, like the market system and bureaucratic experts. And I mean, Hegel was no Democrat, but, you know, if you squint a little bit, you can read a little bit of the kind of deliberative democratic element. Anyway, was this at all in the background, or is that helpful in thinking through?
I can't deny it. I think, you know, once if you start your academic career in philosophy with Hegel, you'll never get completely away, I guess, because he was, I mean, I'm not a fan of everything he did, but he was a really great thinker in the sense that he really thought through lots of challenges and problems and tensions between different things. And sometimes I have these deja vu experiences when I read contemporary philosophy that is not historically informed. And I think, oh, isn't that what Hegel did here or there in his writings? And one reason why I was always drawn to that kind of theorizing more than to sort of first principles abstract theorizing is that I really want to understand principles in their lived realization. I feel that even just epistemically speaking, I don't quite understand these things when they are just abstract words. How do we know that we are talking about the same thing if we just say dignity or freedom or what have you, instead of really thinking through their real life implementations? And I think, you know, what people then sometimes do is that they start using pet examples and make up little vignettes about, you know, is it that kind of freedom or that kind of freedom? But as a matter of temperament, I find it much more interesting to then also think about real life cases and to also think about, well, you know, what can go wrong if we, for example, emphasize one normative value very much and forget about its relation to other values. And so I'm very interested in what it means to really live by certain values and not just think about their abstract sense and their justification, but what they can mean in practice. And I think for me, that then also informs what I think about these values really as abstract principles. For me, it's a kind of back and forth. It's not like, you know, only bottom up. It's more a kind of, I guess, reflective equilibrium in the sense that, yes, we need to think about the abstract principles and then look at their implementation and then go back about what we've learned about what these values really are. So I'm always moving back and forth. And I find it pretty fascinating that both in that line of work in political epistemology, but also in other stuff I do, sometimes you have these little reports from what's happening in real life where you realize that it's the biggest philosophical questions like freedom versus equality showing up in very everyday situations. And that's something that I find fascinating and interesting.
Great. I wanted to talk first about political epistemology and generally your approach to knowledge. And then maybe we could talk briefly about the three mechanisms, market, deck, experts, and democracy. But first on knowledge, you develop and argue for a kind of pragmatic, as you say, socially situated account of knowledge, which is connected to this project, as I understand it, you know, like an effort to move away from kind of traditional Platonic view of truth and knowledge as something that's like objective and universal, and that's from the view from nowhere, towards an understanding of truth and knowledge that's pragmatically useful, that's socially situated, that's from particular perspectives. So maybe you could, sort of sketch that, flesh in that, what you mean by political epistemology, how it's related to, and I think this other key term that you use, which is epistemic justice, and how justice and knowledge are related to one another.
Yeah, so I guess a slogan would be to say we never know alone. We're always members of epistemic communities. And as human beings, we're just the kinds of creatures who use language, who grow up in communities that have certain conceptions of reality. And before we can form our own individual judgments, we are already shaped by these communities. And this may now sound very relativistic, but that's not my point. Because given that we all are socially embedded, we can still come to certain agreements and we can come to certain points of view that people from different perspectives can actually share, and sort of not looking upwards towards some Platonic sky and how we could get there, but more looking sidewards and trying to understand how, by sharing our different perspectives, we can get to the best possible grasp of reality. And we don't need to agree on everything, but there are certain things where, and that's a formulation I'm taking over from the literature, where reality pushes back if we don't get it right. So if you don't understand that corona is a potentially deadly infectious disease and we don't take policies based on these insights, then reality will push back and will end up being very tragic for many people. And what's the relation to justice here? Well, if you have this picture of a kind of horizontal plane where different perspectives need to be brought together, then it's immediately clear that there are questions about, well, whose voices do we actually hear and who's being excluded or marginalized in these processes in which we come to an agreement about what we call reality. And then all the historically grown injustices that we have in our societies along lines of class and race and gender and so on, they also show up as forms of epistemic injustice. And Miranda Fricker has coined this term, although some people have said it has actually already been framed before by other thinkers. And she focused very much on the role of the individual, either as a speaker whose statements do or do not get taken up by others, or in what she calls hermeneutic injustice, focusing on the extent to which different groups in societies have concepts for describing their own experiences and had the opportunity to develop concepts and ideas and metaphors for describing their experiences. And I think those are important points, but they're sort of only describing certain steps in these long, complicated processes of how we come to agree to reality. And I think there are even deeper questions about, for example, who gets access to different positions of expertise. Why is it that, philosophy is a very white discipline, for example, in the sense that lots of non-white people have trouble getting into that field and becoming experts in that domain. And so ultimately, I think all this, what we know about social injustice, also needs to be taken into account when we think about what we know and what we don't know and how we evaluate different input into our knowledge generation processes. So it's not just these punctual things here and there. You have a little bit of epistemic injustice. It's really the structural thing of whose knowledge counts in society. And to make it very concrete when it comes to corona, so I mean, there was a very interesting phase at the beginning of the lockdowns. I'm not sure it was exactly the same in the US, but probably yes, where everyone listened to the epidemiologists and the virologists. No one listened to the child psychologists at this point. Sweden, maybe. I mean, Sweden had a different approach. But the question of what it does to children to be locked down and not to be able to meet other kids and so on, not to be able to get proper education, that was simply not on the radar. And that's a kind of hierarchization between different forms of expertise that It was maybe understandable in that concrete situation because it was all about saving lives and so on. But still, after a while, it was very important that other voices that sort of focus on other aspects of reality were also brought into the discussion because they saw other things that the epidemiologists did not see, namely, you know, what kind of psychological effects is it going to have on young people if you have these endless lockdowns? And so, you know, that's a kind of hierarchization between different forms of expertise. And that's something that you see very often in many forms of decision making, who gets invited, which disciplines are considered to be sort of the crown disciplines of a certain field, like surgery in medicine or in philosophy, maybe metaphysics, I don't know. So that is a problem. And often you then see that it also correlates in interesting ways with markers of social status, although not always necessarily, but all these things matter for understanding how good our understanding of reality is and where we might really have big blind spots because of social injustice.
Yeah, I was thinking of another example with coronavirus. There's actually a case that's going through the courts right now about this. I think it's called the Great Barrington Declaration. It's a bunch of scientists, I think, who disagreed with the mainstream scientific approach to epidemiological approach to the coronavirus in the early days. And this is a case of experts disagreeing with one another. And there, I guess the worry was that the administration put pressure on social media to sort of downplay the results of this declaration. But in any case, I mean, there's certainly this struggle, I think, you know, in the political setting to make certain voices, you know, louder than others in the debate. I was thinking, I mean, this is a very useful way of thinking about knowledge just that in general. I mean, I was teaching Plato's Republic recently, and you know, I mean, there is something powerful about the Platonic view of the cave, right? Where you have this view of knowledge that's like extracting yourself from images projected on a cave and making the long voyage up to truth. And there's something, I don't know, that there's a way that provides a kind of engine for discovery and for the pursuit of knowledge. That in a way, if you, you know, to abandon that Platonic view, I'm a little worried if you lose that engine. But it sounds like this sort of this more lateral view that if you put justice at the heart of it, that there's a view of, you know, sort of procedural inclusion that can be an engine for greater discovery and truth. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I mean,
That's very interesting because my instinctive reaction was to say, well, maybe the prisoners should just talk to each other. They don't even have to get out of the cave. But that's too simple because I do want to acknowledge what I think is at least one possible reading of the Platonic ascent to truth, which is exactly the expert community mechanism, where it is really about learning something, understanding something that the average person would not understand and might remain in, you know, some picture-like imagination about. And as an expert, you become part of a smaller community that tries to really get to the truth of certain things. So I think truth remains a crucial ideal, but I would argue for a concept of truth with a small t in the sense that the things we can really have certainty about tend to be relatively small, specific things like specific research results, specific studies in specific contexts. In the social sciences, it's arguably even messier than in the natural sciences. And the kind of knowledge that we typically need for political decision making isn't just a bunch of very specific results from specific studies that we can all agree on have been done, you know, methodologically in the best possible way. And in that sense, and you know, peer reviewed and checked. And in that sense, we can say they get something that's true, but that still doesn't help us because we still need to have ways of connecting the dots and understanding what these different pieces of evidence mean for the bigger picture. And for decision making, we typically need the bigger picture. And then you're back at a picture where different communities need to talk to each other collaterally, as it were. So we again in the horizontal picture about, okay, you have this specific expertise, I have that expertise. What can we actually say about reality out there? And the process in which the International Panel on Climate Change, for example, is operating is a little bit like this. So you have experts from historical research on how ice shields developed. You have people doing rain patterns, people doing ocean temperatures, and they all try to understand to what extent the little truths they have add up to a bigger picture. And that's what politics can then work with. And I think that's something we probably also need more for other areas of life. These kind of integrative, synthetic approaches, trying to bring different forms of expertise together.
That's great. So let's talk about the market first. The market's one important means of acquiring knowledge in society. Hayek is a useful figure here. You talk a little bit about Hayek. You talk a little bit about Adam Smith. You know, market mechanisms such as like price signals, for example, can give us some information about the preferences of people in society, but it also can be corrupted in ways that we've been talking about. For example, you know, I mean, I think you use the example of advertising, but you know, many other examples come to mind of the ways in which the market can actually distort features of the world and give us the wrong picture. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the market and where you see the sort of, you know, possibilities for market, you know, generation and acquisition of knowledge, and where you see the pitfalls.
Yes. So in a way, I talk about the market in the book at two different levels. And one is a level of the history of ideas, or almost something like cultural history. I mean, I'm not doing cultural history myself, but I read up on the influence of certain economic ideas on society. And what's striking is that this picture of markets as these mechanisms for processing decentralized knowledge, this was hugely influential because it sounds so magnificent and it sounds also very democratic. So everyone enters the market somehow on an equal footing. Everyone has their own desires. Everyone has their own possibilities of producing something. And then through the price mechanism, these different things are brought together and you don't need any authoritarian centralized planner to take care of things. So that was just an immensely powerful narrative, which really also led to the dismantling of lots of expert institutions, and it led to the introduction of market-like mechanisms in areas of social life where it really doesn't make sense, but you try to mimic it through indicators and so on. And I think this has been hugely harmful, and we just need to acknowledge that this narrative is, I mean, no one would officially subscribe to it any longer, but it's still sort of deeply rooted in many arguments and even goes far into the middle or even the left of the political spectrum, that you still think, oh, the market has this epistemic functionality. And so that's why we need it. So that's one thing that I discuss, that this has been really an overreach of that narrative. What I try to do is to then on a substantive level, so not history of ideas, but really systematic argument, is to say, well, maybe in an epistemically well-ordered society, there is some space for the market to really fulfill this function, but it takes a lot of good regulation to make sure that this can even work. And it doesn't make sense in all areas of life. For example, in healthcare, people are not sovereign consumers, and people care about doctors being trustworthy and reliable and not about having a lot of choice between different therapies. I mean, it can also matter, but as a patient, I don't really have the knowledge and expertise to understand what I need. And I'm also often not in the right psychological state for choosing. And so other values are really more important. So there, all these arguments are really difficult to apply. You mentioned advertisement. Advertisement is interesting because it introduces a kind of endogeneity in the whole argument, in the sense that you say, okay, markets are great for satisfying people's preferences, But then through advertisement, you actually try to shape the preferences that people have, and then you satisfy them. And then it becomes unclear what the normative foundation of such an argument can still be. So is the situation A, better, where everyone's preferences are not shaped by advertisement and they also don't get them satisfied through the market, or situation B, where we have advertisement and these preferences are first created and then satisfied? I mean, we need other independent arguments for then choosing between situation A and situation B. And there are other issues. And just to throw in one last point that I've also worked on earlier in other contexts, there's also this idea that financial markets are somehow these great predictive machines that tell us what the real economy is doing, and that they incorporate all the information, and then the course of certain shares tells us exactly how well a certain company is doing and what the profit rates multiplied by the risk assumptions will be in the future. And that's also a very distorted picture, because financial markets, if they can reflect anything at all, they can only reflect things that are really undergirded by money. And so the needs of many people who don't have a lot of money, they wouldn't show up in this kind of register that the financial market is taken to be. So I also think that this focus on the financial market as this real life mirror of the economy is very misguided and doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's good. So, I mean, maybe just say a little bit about, yeah, how you have in, what you have in mind in terms of the regulation of the market then. Is it in terms of the sort of democratic institutionalist picture? I mean, because one of the things I'm wondering is, you know, so how far into the market should sort of democratic deliberative regulation go? And is there a possibility that then you could, you know, with too much regulation, you could sort of lose what, you know, I mean, this is the old worry of Hayek, right? You regulate too much and then you lose that price signal, like mechanism for actually providing something useful for what the consumer wants are.
Well, I think market regulation should not be considered only from the epistemic perspective. There can be other reasons for regulation, like, you know, certain goods should not be traded for moral reasons or whatever. So, but if you focus on the epistemic side, I would actually, in a way, want to turn the burden of proof around. I would want to say, show me that in a certain area or in the demand for a certain kind of goods, it makes sense to rely on the market. And then you can think about what are the criteria for thinking that the price signal will actually have a reasonable function here. And when I think about something like, I don't know, the market for food products, that's an area where people have very different tastes. So that's something that's different from health needs, in the sense that, you know, I want to get the best therapy. I don't want to choose between five flavors of different therapies. You need hygiene control and you need regulation for food safety, but you can put this in place. And then within such a framework, you can say, okay, let people choose what kind of products they like, and let companies try out new tastes of yogurt. And, you know, if we make sure no one is being exploited in the process and there's no harm to the environment, then maybe in such a limited space, the price signal will really tell companies what people want, and people will really realize, okay, maybe these products are a little bit more expensive to produce, and that's why, you know, maybe it's not worth for me buying the, I don't know, ananas yogurt, maybe I go for the apple taste, whatever. So in such well-regulated contexts, maybe it can do the trick. But and you ask about overregulation, I think that is a real risk. But at the moment, we're in a situation where I think there's far more under-regulation or misregulation than over-regulation. Although, as a general sort of approach here, I mean, of course, it makes sense to say more or less regulation, but often I think it's more important to ask regulation in whose favor do we actually have. I'm not at all in favor of a lot of regulation in the sense of a lot of bureaucracy and long forms and whatever, but I'm in favor of, if you want to call it that, a lot of regulation when it comes to holding companies to account, because companies are often the more powerful market actors and they can do a lot of harm if they are not held to account. And so sometimes seemingly simple shifts like turning around who's accountable or who has the burden of proof for something, they don't add a lot of information in a quantitative sense, but they really shift the power relations in markets. And I think that's more the way of looking at it. Who has the power to do certain things here? Who might, you know, do certain kinds of harms? How can we control those? And how do we set the incentives right?
One of the other things you talk about later in the book is you kind of returned a little bit about your previous book about kind of workplace democracy, I guess, to sort of put it in a brief way. I mean, I was wondering if there's a connection here in this with workplace democracy in the sense that, you know, your democratic institutionalist approach and thinking about sort of how these different mechanisms can generate knowledge, thought against the background of a kind of democratic regime that that if you do more democratizing work kind of within the workplace, I mean, the workplace, there's this sort of authoritarian character to it often in most workplaces. You have this boss who's just said sort of all the workers are under the arbitrary will of the boss. And so, you know, the sort of egalitarian flavor of the picture of the market, you know, is sort of set against this very authoritarian internal structure. And so I wonder if, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you think that sort of more democratizing of the workplace can actually have sort of beneficial effects in terms of how the market can generate, you know, better forms of knowledge?
Yes, I mean, I think the case for workplace democracy is normatively overdetermined in the sense that you have a whole range of arguments, preventing abuse, giving people voice, giving people the opportunity to learn democratic practices. But if you just want to focus on the epistemic side of things, there is both an internal and an external effect that one could argue for in terms of, you know, introducing workplace democracy in order to improve the epistemic conditions. The internal effect is that in lots of organizations that are very hierarchical, knowledge that's sort of low in the hierarchies doesn't actually reach the decision makers that are higher up. So the boss only gets the good news, that kind of thing. And so they actually make bad decisions internally because they don't have good ways of using their own knowledge, because people are too afraid to actually speak truthfully to their bosses. And so if you have more democratic, more egalitarian relations within organizations, it's likely that they will actually get a better sense of, for example, you know, what do our customers actually really want? And can say the employees that deal directly with customers, can they actually truly honestly say what customers want? And then you have better chances to make good decisions internally. Externally, I think, I mean, that's not something I've thought through systematically, but I think one can make a case that more democratic firms are probably also better connected to society in the sense that there are more people there who, you know, they are employees, but they're also citizens. They are local citizens, they're national citizens. And so there are more opportunities for input to come from society into companies. And also, I think there's a greater likelihood of companies being held to account because people have an understanding of what's going on internally, and you might get more whistleblowing and also fear of whistleblowing, and I mean it in a positive sense, that if a company tries to do something that may, you know, just about be legal, but actually very much against the values of a society, that some internal members of such an organization would then actually dare to speak out about this, maybe they don't even have to do it. They can just say internally, look, we don't want this to get out. And, you know, it's the anticipation of whistleblowing can then already have an effect. So I think there's also a question about the character of organizations in society, and authoritarian hierarchical organizations just have fewer possibilities of picking up the values and also the changing priorities of society. And just to make this a bit more concrete, what I think one sees in many organizations at this point in time is that lots of employees, especially young employees, actually really want to make a difference when it comes to the climate and to climate-friendlier policies. But decision makers are still very much in the logic of profit maximization, and they only want to hear whatever, you know, contributes to the bottom line of a company. And so if these companies were more democratic, their employees could actually carry their environmental concerns better into the decision-making processes within these companies. That's at least what I see. I'm not saying it's the case in all companies, of course, but there's a generational dimension with younger people being more environmentally aware, and younger people tend to be low in the hierarchy. So from that perspective, you know, more democratic organizations would also be able to follow more quickly when there are new insights, such as the necessity of doing something against climate change that young people pick up.
Let's talk about experts. I mean, experts are sort of expert generation of knowledge is an interesting phenomenon because experts claim to have knowledge, so right, like about medicine or about, you know, lots of different things that I have no clue about. And then I'm faced with the question, is caffeine bad for me? Or is that, you know, I Google and I find out caffeine's terrible for me. And then I keep Googling and it turns out that it's great for me or something like that. In any case, I have this, you know, the Demos, I think, has a difficult time with assessing claims to expertise because, the democratic institutions are expected to hold experts accountable, but then like democratic institutions are not capable of holding experts accountable because they don't have the knowledge that experts do, but experts disagree with one another. So maybe you could help us with this. You develop what you call a partnership model of the partnership being between experts and sort of democratic citizens. So you could kind of walk us through that, how you sort of resolve this puzzle.
Well, I think it is actually a real tension, and we can only try to manage it. We will not be able to get rid of it because it is this fundamental difference between unequal authority of experts and democratic equality. So the first thing is to simply accept the challenge and then to see, okay, how can we distribute the tasks for managing this difficult relation in the best possible way? And I call it a partnership model because I think both the expert communities and society at large really need to understand the challenge, need to play their role in managing it. And there are different dimensions of it. For example, if an expert community, and by the way, I should say, I always think about it as expert communities because a single expert, well, how can you trust them? I mean, you need a group that really develops knowledge together and that gets checked and verified and so on. So it's about the different groups that I'm talking about here. And if such an expert community discovers something that is of broader societal relevance, then it's a very basic imperative that they need to find ways of sharing that knowledge with others. And then you get into very practical questions about how can you communicate about difficult topics in, say, chemistry? Say they find that a certain molecule is actually harmful to human health or the health of animals or the environment, and they need to translate this into a language that citizens and politicians and other decision makers can actually understand. So there is a duty to move towards the non-experts, but there is also a duty on the side of society to make sure that knowledge can get picked up in the right way, but also to not overburden expert communities with expectations in the sense that they also need to be given the space to use their own methods, to follow their own epistemological practices in order to generate knowledge. So if you only want the experts to do certain things for society, you're in a way destroying the space within which they do what makes them experts. So it's always a fine balance. And of course, when you then look at the concrete institutional setups, you get to talk about questions like academic freedom, the funding of research, independence from funding that comes from interested parties like, you know, certain companies. Maybe as an expert community, so you don't want to work for them if it's totally clear that they expect certain outcomes from you. So, and one thing that makes all these questions difficult is that you might think this is all about setting the right incentives and creating the right institutions in the sense of laws and rules and regulations. But all these knowledge processes are very subtle and they can be influenced in very subtle ways. And you might tweak certain results a little bit. And trying to create accountability on the model of kind of legal accountability is very, very difficult. And so ultimately, I argue for a moralized understanding of the partnership where experts really take a moral responsibility for these processes. And they are responsible in a moral sense, not only in some kind of institutional sense, for doing their best to deal with knowledge responsibly. So trust, not just accountability, in terms of these different models of relating to knowledge.
Yeah, I was wondering about this relationship between the demos and experts, not just in terms of sort of an epistemic inequality, but a kind of, I think maybe a more basic worry about the trust of the demos for the experts. I started this by talking about Plato, and of course there's this sort of old longstanding worry about as the sort of mistrust of democratic peoples for so-called experts, because there's already an inegalitarian relationship. So maybe this is an element, I think, of your the sort of moralized character to it. You can sort of repair that that inequality with a sort of appeal to the experts have for the common good. So maybe you could say a little bit about that. But I was also wondering about sort of a more contemporary setting. I mean, experts really have, you know, in some quarters there's kind of like deep mistrust for experts, right? I mean, in part from COVID. But I think it even goes back before that. I mean, I think of some of these examples about, you know, like, you know, the psychology field, right, and some social sciences. I mean, there are just some of these fields in the social sciences where these studies were just sort of broadcast through media for years and years and years as sort of the truth about things. And then it turns out that so many of these studies just don't replicate. And then it's just sort of like, well, you know, I mean, what's the rational view then? I should probably only trust about 2% of these studies that come out, because these are only about the ones that can replicate. Yes. So do you have thoughts, I mean, about, you know, sort of either of these features of this sort of mistrust of experts and how it can be repaired?
Yes. I think one of the big challenges is, and that's again something that experts need to be aware of, but it's also a question of the social environment in which they operate, is that as an expert, you stand out in one dimension, and that's the thing that you know more about than others, and that you're part of that expert community, but you don't stand out in any other respect. So as a citizen, you're still exactly, you know, of the same moral value as any other citizen. And also, there are very many different types of expertise, and we tend to think about scientists, and I mean, we've used many examples from science now, but lots of people are not scientists, and yet they are experts on certain things. You just need to delineate very carefully what that is. It could be local knowledge. It could be indigenous forms of knowledge. It could be certain forms of experiential knowledge. And if we say expertise gives you certain privileges, then we need to apply this to all meaningful forms of expertise. And I think one thing that went wrong, many things went wrong, but one thing is that we've had many cases where expertise was also coupled with other forms of social privilege that are more difficult to justify. So higher salaries, high social status, the social practice of experts being the ones who are also to speak more when it comes to other issues that are outside of their area of expertise. And also people who are invited to speak as experts then actually abusing the opportunity to say whatever they want and not sticking to their own pretty narrow, typically, field of expertise. And I think that has not been helpful for the relationship between people who are not experts in certain areas and the people who are experts. But I mean, as I said, probably everyone is expert on something. It's just, you know, how do we treat these different forms of expertise? And now when it comes to the specific problems of social psychology or other fields where we have these replication crises, I mean, there are really loads of questions. And in the book, I can't go into a lot of detail there about the incentives and the social setup of academia and all the pathologies it has created. And I mean, one of the reasons for the replication crisis is the pressure to publish and then certain standards about what counts as a study that's acceptable, how do you do this, how much control is necessary, and so on, which people followed as a kind of cooking book recipe in order to get studies out without really thinking and asking deeper questions about, well, what are we actually trying to do here? And how can we make sure that these studies are really meaningful and really grasp the reality out there? So I think, I mean, this sounds now maybe like I'm trying to advertise our own field, but the subfield of philosophy of science. But I think one of the things that went wrong is that lots of empirical scientists did not understand enough philosophy of science to actually think critically about what they are doing, what certain studies can and cannot show. And because of this cooking book recipe approach, they just did things without asking themselves critical questions. And then we got lots of false positives out there. And that has been very harmful for the public perception of science. By the way, I think it's not only psychology, it's also the fact that for dieting and health, there are all these headlines about, you know, eating strawberries makes you 2% healthier or whatever, which are really taken out of context and where the communication was very bad. And I mean, your question sort of also reflected on, you know, what can we do and how could trust be rebuilt? I think one key element is that when scientists and other experts communicate, they need not only to communicate about their specific studies, but also about what science is and what it can and cannot do, and why it is that sometimes studies might seem to contradict each other, and how science builds knowledge over time, one study at a time, as it were. So I think we also need a broader dialogue about what science can and cannot do, and that will hopefully help to rebuild some trust. If I may add one last point here, I think there's also a question about the overall societal structures. I mean, do people know scientists personally, or are scientists part of a kind of elite bubble and normal people would never ever meet one in person? Is it something that their kids can aspire to be? I mean, how much personal contacts are there between all these different groups? And I really worry about social inequality reinforcing a kind of formation of different castes where different jobs are just going to different social spheres and not others, and that contributing to the kind of distrust that we see.
Yeah, that's very good. I was thinking in the context of my own field here and how I understand the sort of imperative to think about the sort of moral duty of experts, not just their sort of institutional duty. I think experts do generally very well when thinking about their institutional duty. So in my own field, I mean, we have a very sort of rigorous, in my department, we have a very rigorous training regimen for aspiring political scientists, right? So they have to take 5 methods courses, which is a pretty amazing number to me, right? I never took 5 methods courses as a graduate student. And so they do very rigorous sort of, and it's very, very much according to the scientific model of sort of division and specialization of labor, and again, getting very, very narrow. But there's little attention to the sort of broader questions of how this little piece of, you know, contribution sort of integrates with the broader endeavor of the whole. And that's how I'm understanding your imperative, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, and your imperative to think about the moral mission, that there needs to be some attention, say in the education of an expert or anything, to how this little tiny and an increasingly smaller sliver, because division and specialization of knowledge, it becomes more accentuated with every passing year. There needs to be some attention to how everything fits back together. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. And as a kind of accompanying project, but in a team, while I was working on the book, I was also working on a project at the Global Young Academy, which is an international association of young scientists, where we try to reflect more on, well, you could say the moral education, the moral responsibilities of scientists, and you know, how do you communicate with the public? How do you think about possible biases in your research? And we developed a project there called Science with Society, where we try to bring insights from the philosophy and the sociology of science to a broader range of, you know, young scientists working in all kinds of fields. Because I think this kind of meta discussion about what we are doing, how does it fit together with what other fields do, how does it fit together in sort of the constellations in society with different groups wanting different things, that's something that's really missing. It often happens in kind of informal conversations between colleagues, but I think we need to have more of that. We need to become more reflective of how we are perceived by the outside, what we do to listen to others, at what places we might also need to say, look, sorry, we are experts. We're not going to do this or that because that's not what we can contribute to society. So I'm not saying that experts should just, you know, do whatever the public wants them to do. Sometimes they need to push back. But we need to think more about that relation. And I think lots of scientists, especially in the natural science or engineering or so, they don't have the moral vocabulary to think about these questions. They sometimes have very strong intuitions, from what I've seen in just private conversations with lots of people in these fields. They have strong, idealistic ideas. They want to contribute to society and to normatively valuable endeavors like preventing climate change or curing cancer, whatever. I mean, that they have a reason for why they want to be in this field. But the kind of reflection on, okay, how do you bring together these idealistic goals and your day-to-day grind in the machinery of academia with its very specific institutional incentives, that's a conversation that I think we need to have more. Because we're always citizens and scientists, as it were. And how do we bring this together?
Great. So let's conclude by talking about democratic deliberation, which is the third part of Lisa Herzog's philosophy of right, the third moment in your ethical life, as it were. One of the context here I wanted to ask you about, I mean, a democratic deliberation is, of course, another way in which knowledge can be created and generated in the modern age. And the context I wanted to ask you about is the way in which you launch a kind of critique against the sort of the current approach that's kind of in vogue to think about the importance of autocratic institutions of sortition. You draw citizens' names out of a hat and you put them on citizen juries, or even more radically, on some representative institutions. And these are meant to sort of replace representative institutions because those maybe are too oligarchic. And the idea is to bring back the average citizen into knowledge generation. Maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, sort of what you take to be the sort of deficiency of that approach, and how you think about reforming democratic institutions along your lines.
Yes, thank you. But on the one hand, I think these things are fantastic. And I'm a big fan and avid reader of all these studies that come out about these new forms of citizen assemblies, deliberative bodies, all these things. And the great thing that they do show is that it's possible to have normal people discuss with each other coming from different backgrounds. The effect of polarization in countries like the US that we talked about earlier doesn't actually hold them back. Those who do participate, they are willing to talk across party lines. So that's great. And then comes the big but. And the big but is that it hasn't really led to any substantive reforms up to now, in the sense that, you know, the proposals were developed. Iceland had a reform of its constitution done in that way. But so far, hardly anything except the local level has been taken up by real politics, as it were. And so I think if one wants to pursue that line, one really needs to think much harder about the integration of these new formats into the existing political structures. But I ultimately think that there is no shortcut around also reforming existing political institutions. And that may seem an impossible task. It's definitely harder. And there's always something attractive about setting up something new and just not worrying about all that's going wrong in the old system. Here's something new, let's do that. But I think we still need to think about the hard work of also reforming the existing institutions, for example, parliaments. And then you get questions such as, well, who is actually in parliament? What, you know, which groups are being represented, which groups aren't represented? And then you find, for example, results in political science that study in a lot of detail about what is keeping working class people out of politics. And that's then, you know, the kind of knowledge that you need to think about possible reforms at that level. So I think, you know, I'm not against the autocratic wave, but I think it's just wrong to put all hopes on that methodology without thinking about broader reforms of existing institutions. And ultimately, a lot of these reforms also have to do with socioeconomic inequality, and they will be resisted by powerful and rich interests, to put it very bluntly, unless we also find ways of fighting socioeconomic inequality. There is just a limit to how unequal you can let a society get if you still want democracy to function well. And that's for many epistemic arguments that I provide in the book. I think there are also lots of other arguments for why this is the case. We can't just be equal citizens if one of us has 300 times the income of another person. That's not realistic.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really like about your book, again, the sort of institutionalist approach, is that you don't have to rely so much on thinking about democracy and the way it can contribute or not contribute to knowledge by focusing on the individual voter, right? This is often the focus. It's either, you know, the critics of democracy focus on like how ignorant, you know, stupid the American public is, right? Because they look at polls of individual voters, but that's often not where the action is when thinking about big modern representative democracies. You know, there's been work, for example, on parties. I don't know if you have anything to say about, you know, parties in particular, but political parties, you know, could be a ripe source of democratic knowledge. These are ways to sort of aggregate particular approaches. And if you have a bunch of them in society, then you can, you know, you can
absolutely
have
same for unions and other associations. I think we need to think much more about these intermediate bodies. Because it's unrealistic to think that citizens will always acquire in-depth knowledge about all political issues that are at play at a particular moment. That's just not how our lives function. And I mean, Kevin Elliott has this idea of dividing the work also between different citizens, as, you know, some citizens focus on environmental issues and others on gender justice, whatever. I think that's part of the answer, but I think it's also very important to think about collective institutions, and knowledge is a public good. So you also don't need all citizens to sort of reinvent the wheel by doing all the epistemic work themselves. So if I have a reliable source of information that can share it, that I can share it from, then I don't have to do all the Googling. And in that sense, we need to think about it, but knowledge and democracy much more in these institutional and collective terms. And what individual voters know depends very much on where they are situated in society, which is not surprising if you assume this socially embedded conception of knowledge that I'm actually starting from.
Right. Knowledge is not, in your view, in individuals' heads. It's actually embodied and distributed in
It's sort of out there, and we need to relate to it in the right ways.
Yeah. Oh, again, Hegelian. Lisa, this is great. I love it. Yeah, good. Well, Lisa, this has been a fabulous conversation. I really, really enjoy talking to about these things with you. So thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.